I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Garrett, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Andy. How are you?
I always Monday after a major is like a weird day. I feel like it's like you're just kind of tired of working all weekend, so it's just a strange day. And then you're thinking about all the stuff, and sometimes you get a little bit more perspective the longer you wait from a major championship. But what a weekend of golf, huh?
Yeah, amazing weekend of golf. There was a lot of golf to watch for sure, even not at the PGA Championship. You know, there's some interesting tournaments going on outside of it. So I definitely got a load of it. And I feel you on that, you know, the Monday after a major, there's a little bit of a letdown, but you still have some of that buzz going from the excitement of the tournament. And this was definitely an exciting tournament.
Yeah, I was just returning some stuff at the store at a couple stores with my wife, and I was, you know, this is what when I'm waiting, I'm thinking about Tony Finau, and I looked it up, and here he's only played 16 majors. He's finished in the top 10 7 times. It's kind of nuts. Yeah.
I know. Well, yeah, no, completely. You know, it gives legitimacy to the idea that there's actually a curse on him. I mean, the guy plays so well so often, and he just doesn't have any wins. I mean, it's amazing. But what's funny to me about that story is the fact that you were on an errand with your wife and you were thinking about Tony Finau, which is certainly exactly where my head is at the Monday after a major championship. You know, I can't have a normal human conversation with anybody. So it's good that we're going to get all our takes out there right now, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. When doing all those shotgun start spotlights over the quarantine with all those historic players, like 40% top 10 rate in the prime of your career and majors is like really unbelievable. And yes, that's essentially what Finau's at right now.
Yeah. No, he's such a great player. He does so many things well. I'd love to figure out what it is that's holding him back. I mean, obviously he's not a great putter, but you know, I mean, one of these weeks he's got to put it together. It's just got to happen.
He made putts yesterday too.
I know. He was closing out those like 5-6 footers down the stretch. Well, he shot 66. He did his job. It's kind of like you and Brendan talked about on the shotgun start. You know, Morikawa jumped out and got it, which is why it was so satisfying, but it was also a bummer for guys like Bryson and Tony Finau who played well, but just, you know, not well enough.
I know. For a while, it looked like we were going to get a 7-man playoff.
that would have been interesting. Yeah. Would have been interesting to see how they would have pulled that off.
What were your thoughts on the golf course? Obviously, you covered the golf course extensively between the article you wrote and as well as the DocuPod that is the podcast before this, Golf in the City, Harding Park. How did you what'd you think of the first major championship at Harding Park?
Well, I thought it was a great success. I mean, it certainly, the tournament justified all of the things that Harding Park's supporters say about it, that it's a great championship venue, it's challenging, it stands up to the best players in the world, and it tends to create drama. It's done that in the San Francisco City Championships, it did that in the Lucky International in the 60s, it's done that in the tournaments that it's held this century. And so all of those advocates of Harding Park, like Bo Lynx, who essentially narrated the story for me on that Fried Egg Stories episode, their perspective on the course, I think, was found a lot of justification this week. I think we also saw some of the things about Harding Park that are less than great, you know, on TV, especially when you're looking at one hole against another, it's sometimes sort of hard to keep track of where you are, unless you're along one of those lake holes. And, you know, the bunkers, the greens just don't introduce a whole lot of interest to the play. But you know what? It came down to the wire. There were a couple of holes that allowed Morikawa to show what he does best, that allowed him to differentiate himself. And so the course did its job. It was dramatic, and it felt good that this championship took place at a true municipal course, a course that's been a true muni for ever since it opened 95 years ago.
I thought one of the things, obviously we're in such weird times and the circumstances didn't allow fans, but I thought one of the best aspects of the golf course is the idea. I think golf in the city, you know, major championship golf within the city is so neat. It's not 40 minutes away. It's not a train ride away. And it brings such an atmosphere. We got it a little bit, even with just the people watching from the street on 13T, which was really neat. Yeah. But that idea of golf in the city, a municipal course and fans is such a cool ingredient with it. And obviously we won't see Harding Park in the PGA Rota for however long, you know, that are booked out for over a decade. And yeah. That's the thing, the one thing that I thought got robbed of the championship. And, you know, when we weren't even sure if we were going to have major championship golf, when they started planning it, I thought it would make a lot of sense to move this one and bring Harding Park back with fans, because I think that was the one thing that really, if that's the X factor of that venue.
Right. Oh, completely. And if you look at the video that's available actually on YouTube of the 2005 American Express Championship, the first big event that was held at Harding Park post-renovation, the duel between Tiger Woods and John Daly, the atmosphere for that, for a WGC, was unbelievable. You know, the crowd was just so in it, and it was so fun to see that course crowded and loud like that. And that would have definitely been part of this championship. I think that was definitely missing. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a bummer, but you know what? We were all still watching at home. There was plenty of tension without the crowd. I kind of wonder, though, I mean, this might be a bad take, but I kind of wonder, like, if the lack of a crowd made things even more, made this even more of an opportunity for somebody like Colin Morikawa. I think it would have just felt different to him down the stretch if there had been thousands of people crowded around him, you know, yelling their lungs out.
Yeah, that's such an interesting thing to debate, because even in lead-up questions to the tournament, there were some responses. I can't remember exactly who press conference I was watching. It was one of the big players. It might have been even Rory. God, I can't remember who it was, but they were talking about how they were struggling to really, without the energy of the crowd, like in regular events, but then being a major, they really knew it was that. And the other question is, I mean, was Colin Morikawa, Scheffler, Wolf at more of an advantage because they're basically a year removed from playing all their events, just like this one was played with no fans, just basically family and officials and agents at college events. You know, that's basically a big name player is going to have 20 agents following him around and equipment guys following him around at a college event, and that's about it. And that's essentially what we see at these new tour events without fans is you know, big name players have more people following them, but it's just officials and, you know, different cohorts of the tour or PGA championship.
Yeah. Yeah. And we heard about it plenty on the telecast. Obviously, Morikawa was familiar with the course, but in a very real sense, this had to feel specifically familiar to him. You know, he's played events that probably looked quite a bit like this in very recent history. You know, all that added up to an opportunity, but you know, that's not to take anything away from how impressive what he did down the stretch was. It's really one of the most unbelievable finishes from a player in a major that I can remember. I mean, who's gone out and grabbed it like that recently? I mean, Brooks did it at Erin Hills.
Yeah, he did it at Erin Hills. I'm trying to think. Shinnecock, he kind of did. I mean, there a lot of guys fell apart there.
Yeah.
Tiger, everybody fell apart around Tiger.
Right.
It's amazing when you think back, because everything's like all the recent memories almost Brooks. It's like Brooks here, Brooks there.
He's been dominant.
Gary Woodland, I will say, he kind of did that. He did. He played so good on Sunday.
That shot on 17, the chip.
Or the shot on 14.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Getting home there. And the way he started, the way he answered Brooks, his charge in that first six holes. That was those first seven holes of that tournament were electric. But what an iconic finish, and I think that was what had to happen, was like just pure excellent play. And who knows, if you play 18 more holes, like some tournaments we see, like if we just kept going, if we keep playing three more days, Henrik Stenson's probably winning at Troon if that tournament turns into a 90 hole tournament or a 108 hole tournament. This tournament, I have no clue who would win if it was 108 holes, you know? Like that's the I think one of the things with it is that we would, if it picked back up today and we're playing Monday a fifth round, it's still anybody's tournament.
No, it was an unbelievable level of golf. People really didn't fall apart. It was just and that might be more fuel for the notion that fans do create a little bit more pressure at majors. It gives it that atmosphere. It reminds you of what the stakes are on a regular basis. And so when you've got a more or less empty course, you know, you're a little more able to lock in. And there were just a whole lot of guys who were locked in on Sunday at Harding Park. And I think it was fun to watch, but I'm not sure that I'd want it every major. I think when we see three or four more like this, we're going to start to yearn for the fans back.
Yeah, what do you think about the setup?
So, you know, it was PGA Championship through and through. I re-listened to your podcast with Kerry Haig this morning, and you know he was very circumspect and professional in that podcast. But I saw, you know, his sort of personality coming through in the setups, and this is what he's done for a number of PGA Championships in a row, where basically it's a pretty conservative setup, and you know it's plenty challenging, but there's nothing that the pros are going to object to. But then there are a couple of holes here and there where there's some creativity introduced to the setup. So you had the 16th hole, which I think between the first day, second day, third day, fourth day, there were some really, really smart changes made to that hole to make it different, and it influenced play in exactly the ways that I would imagine were intended. So they used both the championship tee and what's normally the forward tee at Harding Park, which is about 280 to 290 yards, and then they used a bunch of different pin positions on that green, which has these kind of three different lobes in a middle section. They put the pins on all of those edges, and they moved the tees backward and forward, and the dynamics from day to day were really interesting, really cool, and it paid off in a spectacular shot from Colin Morikawa down the stretch. The defining shot of the tournament was enabled by that smart, varied setup. And so I think that's the MO of the PGA Championship, right? Championship right now that we're seeing. We're not seeing big mistakes on the setup, and the reason for that is that it's pretty tentative for the most part, but there are certain places on the course where there are some smart changes made to the hole, some variety in the playing dynamics from day to day, and I thought it really worked this time. Now, that said, I can't say that, you know, watching just a player who was a few shots off the lead, not a few shots off the lead, say a player who was a number of shots off the lead Sunday morning, just watching that player play this course shot by shot, I'm not sure that that would be that interesting. Whereas if this were Royal Melbourne, that would be fascinating. Royal Melbourne, as it was set up at the President's Cup, you'd want to watch any player in any situation play that course shot for shot. I don't think you could say the same about Harding Park as it was set up for this tournament. You know, I think the players had to rise above and provide the drama on their own. I don't think the course was necessarily giving us anything that was super fascinating in and of itself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I feel like the only holes that created drama were the short par fours, 7 and 16. I felt like 8, 9, 10 was a great stretch of golf. I did enjoy, and Will Knights tweeted this from the Fried Egg account, but the pacing of the golf course. Now, I'm not talking about the design characteristics of the greens or bunkers, but just the way, the rhythm of the difficult versus gettable holes. I thought, you know, you have that first 7 holes where you felt like you really had to take advantage of those holes because 8 and 9 were, you know, pretty much playing at, if you played those in 8, you know, a bogey and a par, you weren't going to lose ground. And then you had 10, you could get one. And then all of a sudden you have another tough stretch of golf for a few holes. And then you got a couple gettable holes coming down the stretch. And then 18's another tough hole. I liked the way, the rhythm of the round where you had these periods of, you know, you got to get this done. And I think if you look back on Dustin Johnson's round, him not making a birdie, Grant, he parred 8, 9, he played those great, but not getting one at 10 from a great drive was really the nail in his kind of coffin, and one that you look back on, and every guy in that top 8 players in this event look back on a couple things. And I think that was a cool, the rhythm of an aspect of it was really neat. And I liked that the short par fours, they weren't like a foregone conclusion what was going to happen, you know, what somebody was going to do off the tee, which was neat and something we don't see when the tour goes to the players at the 12th hole, like where that's everybody's going for it.
Yeah, Morikawa made a legitimate in the moment choice on the 16th tee in the 4th round of the tournament. You know, he said to the press afterwards that he, at the beginning of the tournament, he thought he was going to be laying up on that hole, but you know, he called an audible on the tee and he pulled the driver out. You just don't hear that often from pros, that I deviated from what I thought my plan was going to be. And that speaks to a really good setup for that hole. And I think that hole specifically does, I mean, it, you know, the design of it and the setup of it just worked really, really well here. Yeah, I mean, so you're mainly, though, talking about the pacing of the round, the mixture of easy and hard holes. I think you do have to work it both ways at this golf course, right? That there's mm-hmm. a balance of...
limited amount of working. You know, nobody really works it outside of Bubba these days.
What qualifies as working the ball has definitely changed. but when we see even a little bit of curve, we kind of get excited. And then the routing of the course we talked about on the story podcast that we did. Bo Lynx talked about it. Ron Krojcik talked about it. It starts on the inside of the property, and then when you get to that 13th hole, the green sits against Lake Merced, and then you know that you're really heading down the stretch, right? And that makes it a really fun, dramatic tournament golf moment where everything starts to tighten up right as you get out to Lake Merced, and it just feels right. It's exciting. And so, you know, I think that people are looking for simplistic takes on golf courses. Either this golf course represents everything that's bad about architecture or everything that's good about architecture. But I don't think that's the right way to go with Harding Park. I think there's a lot of things that the course does brilliantly and a lot of things that could be much better about the course. Just because this was a great championship doesn't mean that the course couldn't be better. And just because there are some critiques that we have of the greens and the bunkers and various other aspects of the course and the setup, doesn't mean that, a great tournament can't occur here.
Yeah, that I think that's the thing, is that we live in this world of where there's only one right thing, and I always keep going back to the idea that two, even three, even four things can be true about the same thing. Like, you know, the TPC Harding Park had a great championship on it. TPC Harding Park isn't necessarily the greatest championship golf course. And I think TPC Harding Park will be, as rumored, will be a great year in, year out tour stop. I think it's going to be a really cool atmosphere. And I think I like the trend that we're starting to see with more and more events going into cities. And I think it'll draw a great field because obviously Riviera is a great golf course and it always gets a great field. But one of the reasons it gets a great field with superstar players is the idea, like, hey, we got to go spend a week in LA like that. And going and spending a week in San Francisco is appealing to PGA Tour players versus going to spend it in, you know, suburbs of XYZ city. Being able to stay in the city, especially as this tour gets younger and younger, is going to be an appeal. And I think that's one of the things that we, you know, another municipal golf course that's hosting a regular PGA Tour event is Memorial Park in the city, you know, in Houston. So that should be another neat tournament with its own unique atmosphere.
Yeah, we should briefly say a little bit about what you're referring to. So there's going to be, it sounds like, an annual tournament at Harding Park in the fall, hosted by Steph Curry. And I talked a little bit to Ron Krojcik about this, but it didn't make the story podcast. But it sounds like it's basically a done deal. Steph Curry is involved and it will be an event. And there are a couple of things that are really cool about that. One is that fall is the time to be in San Francisco, right? Right now is not the time to be in San Francisco, though
it
was
Mark
cool
Twain
to
say?
See the fog. he said something about the coldest winter I ever spent is a summer in San Francisco, except I wrote a dissertation chapter on Mark Twain about his time in the West Coast, and I found absolutely no evidence that he said anything of the sort. this is not something that Mark Twain said.
This is very conflicting, you know?
But in any case, it's in the fall, San Francisco is great. It's sunny. It's like 70 degrees. It'll be beautiful. And because the tournament is going to have the involvement of Steph Curry, I think that'll give it a little bit of extra juice and it'll make it feel a little more distinct from the normal fall events, right? Which do, I think, kind of blur together and need something to make them stand out. I really believe that Steph Curry is one of the few people who is involved in the golf world who can make an event feel bigger than events in the fall normally feel.
I agree. I believe the plan is to keep Safeway too. So, you know, when players are laying out what they're going to do, all of a sudden a week in Napa, a week in San Francisco, that is pretty appealing. I mean, right now I'm thinking about it and I don't go to and cover many tour events, but now I'm like, you know what? It's a pretty good 2 weeks there.
Yeah. Napa is amazing. Napa's awesome.
It is such a great golf city. You know, it's a unique and cool golf city, as you covered, you know, pretty thoroughly in your podcast, with all the other, you know, the dedication to municipal golf and public golf and then overall golf in the city. There's so many golf courses there and so many golfers in San Francisco.
It's a rich golf culture. I think it's a unique golf culture. You know, San Francisco has long been a city where it can be difficult to be a blue collar person, and it's become more and more difficult recently. But I think golf, and this is surprising for a lot of people to hear, has for many decades been an outlet for blue collar people in San Francisco. Harding Park has been a place where, you know, the Plumbers Union holds its annual tournament. And so the people who play golf in San Francisco tend not to be kind of your stereotype of golf, and that gives the courses a distinctive feel. I don't know if you've been to Glen Eagles, but that's such a fun place to just be. I mean, it's a fun golf course, 9-hole golf course in McLaren Park, and the hang in the clubhouse at the bar is one of the most fun things that I think you can do in golf. And so, you know, the golf
it's basically a dive bar at a 9-hole course.
It's great. I mean, it's got a great view too. Like, it's got this amazing view, and you're sitting there and people are telling stories, and it's just a wonderful place. And so I think that's part of what's really valuable about San Francisco golf, and what needs to be preserved and defended in that city is a certain kind of rough and tumble culture to the golf courses. These are really welcoming places. These are places where you feel comfortable. Even after Harding Park got renovated and turned into this sort of higher class of PGA Tour course, it still retains a lot of that feel. I think significantly through the Fleming Nine, which is within the course, and that's the place that a lot of people will just kind of play casually. But even Harding Park, I believe, partakes of this kind of feel of San Francisco golf, which I believe is different from a lot of different cities. And I hope to see it preserved. You know, San Francisco is a tough place to live now, and I'm a little bit doubtful about the future of the golf courses there. But I hope people stick by them.
Yeah, it's obviously there's a cost of living issue there. And housing issue.
My wife and I were just looking out of curiosity, because we lived in San Francisco for 3 years and we basically got priced out of the city. We couldn't live there anymore. And that was more than 10 years ago. We were just looking at apartments just out of curiosity to see what they go for now. And you're looking at $5,000-$6,000 a month in a lot of places. It's tough. They've got some issues there. But the golf courses are on great pieces of property, and I hope that they choose to save them.
Yeah. So with the golf course, I think that we're going to see a really similar setup at this year's U.S. Open, but we're going to see couldn't get more opposite of green complexes at Wingfoot versus Harding Park, where even CBS is commentating about how flat the greens are. Yeah. There will be no such remarks about Wingfoot. How do you think that will impact the power players we saw, you know, always having wedge in their hands, but not always necessarily? And obviously Morikawa won largely thanks to his putting, but, you know, probably more thanks to the fact he led the field in driving accuracy. How do you think that's going to impact the Bryson? I mean, Bryson drove it pretty dang well, right. But we saw him in the rough a lot. How do you think that'll play out differently?
Well, I'm not sure, and I'd like to actually hear your thoughts about this, because you've been to Wingfoot and you've looked at those greens, but you'd have to assume that iron play would become really, really important, or it would become at least more important than it was at Harding Park, which makes you think about Morikawa again. If he's winning it at Harding Park, it would seem almost that Wingfoot is better suited to him, because there's going to be a real premium on being in the right section of the green.
Yeah. Iron play is going to be huge. One of the things that Jeff Ogilvie always says about U.S. Opens is the underrated U.S. Open skill is chipping. And pitching around the greens is that you have to have a great chipping week, because you're going to miss greens. And then it becomes about how you recover and get up and down. And we're going to see a lot more treacherous surrounds if you miss. That's where, you know, almost always a double bogey is in play around those greens. When you miss the greens, it's almost like, oh boy, I better hit a great shot to have even, you know, just say bogey. And I think that's maybe a little bit of the difference between what we're going to see at the two is, like, Harding Park, if you got it around the greens, you were going to have a pretty good chance at making par. If you're in the wrong spot at Wingfoot, all of a sudden your focus turns to how am I going to save bogey and avoid having to make a 6-footer for bogey? You know, how am I going to make this, you know, I missed my shot. How am I going to make this an easy bogey as opposed to, you know, easy par?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think we'll see a lot more guys get in jail around Wingfoot's greens. That was something that you didn't see as much this week, right? People were, you know, there weren't a lot of like triple, quadruple bogeys when people missed in the wrong spots.
That's one thing I felt like we missed a little. And we saw it, obviously, like Joel Damon triple bogey at the end of Friday was, you know, but that was more the case of, okay, he bladed a 45-yard bunker shot, which is something that could happen. I think about what happened at Shinnecock Hills with, you know, Tiger with a wedge in his hand making triple on the first hole of the tournament. And, you know, I think Spieth made an 8 on 10, if right. I remember correctly.
And guys just not being able to get anywhere near the pin from certain bunkers.
Mm-hmm. Or keep it on the green from certain bunkers.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're going to see. The other idea is when you've got a wedge, but you're in the rough and you're hitting across the greens at Wingfoot, and we're going to have a video pretty soon all about the greens, but the greens at Wingfoot sit up, and then they have really big pronounced slopes. So if you're on the wrong side in the rough on a hole hitting to short side, your ball is landing on a grade in the green. Say it's a 5%, 6% slope. You have no chance versus at Harding Park, we didn't see slopes above 2%.
So I'm curious. The players seem to like Harding Park a lot. You know, they said really positive things about it. They usually like PGA Championship setups. There's a lot of respect for how this championship gets set up. Obviously not the same is true of the US Open and the USGA and the players. What do you think the players are going to think of Wingfoot, or does it depend on setup?
I think they're going to feel sometimes the one thing Kerry Haig said so much in the interview that I did with him was fair. The idea of fair.
Yeah.
And I think it showed in the setup. It was nobody's ever going to complain about the way that PGA was set up. It was imminently fair. They were complaining about the lack of sand and bunkers. I mean, which is a hazard. It just kind of gives you a lens into the. And I've been there at playing as an amateur. Not, obviously not, but where you totally buy into the unfair thing. There's a entitlement thing as a player in a tournament where you feel like everything should be fair. But at Wingfoot, you definitely have the potential of a situation where the crowd could start to think that it's unfair. And by the crowd, I mean the players, and the locker room talk might push it in a certain direction of, oh, can you believe where they put the pin just because, you know, that. And I think that's it's where I get frustrated a lot, is like your point of point of golf overarching is overcoming the obstacles in front of you with the equipment you have, you know?
Yeah.
And
right.
And that gets lost sometimes when you get in the discussion of fair. It's like, well, was it the same for everybody? Yes. Then it was fair, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but it doesn't feel like it to players because from their perspective, they may have played well or hit a good shot and it didn't work out for them. And that's really disappointing in a major, right? And that's hard to deal with emotionally. And so you have to deal with it somehow, right? You've got to process it somehow. And it seems like the way that, at least between the players and the USGA, it's worked out that they process it by blaming the USGA. And you know, that didn't happen as much last year at Pebble Beach because we saw the setup get a little more toward the PGA Championship end of the spectrum. So I wonder if, given the severity of Wingfoot's greens, whether they're going to be really cautious at Wingfoot.
I think, And I think you could set it up very fairly, and Wingfoot's still going to do its job. You know, I think one of the things that the USGA has to deal with at your Shinnecocks and your Wingfoots also that doesn't get talked about is the balance with dealing with the membership side of things, where they are being welcomed into these clubs that are very closed off normally. And the idea of the members have a view of what the score should be, you know, and golf is changing so much with distance and scoring that the idea of trying to appease this, you know, to the public silent party that is pretty much invisible the week of the championship, they're in a tough position where they have to balance both sides of the coin there a little bit. Because we all know that memberships love to puff their chest out about how difficult their golf course is. Like, I can't go and play Butler without them insisting on me playing the back tees. And I'll say that I don't want to play the back tees. That won't be fun at all. Like, I'm going to get my ass kicked. And you know, sure enough, then I shoot like a 78 with no birdies. And it's like, well, that wasn't fun at all. But yeah. It's like that feeling of, it has to be hard for the pros, which I don't even understand at the long, you know.
That's been with us for a long time, right? That's a big part of the story at the 1974 Wingfoot U.S. Open, which was famously difficult. The members were advocating for, they were happy, right, that the course was that difficult. I don't think that that's changed much. And what you've got at Wingfoot also is a very powerful membership too. Like the people who belong to that club are not nobodies in the world, and they can throw their weight around. And so that's very interesting, because at a place like Chambers Bay, you don't have that. So it's open season on Chambers mm-hmm. Bay, but
or Erin yeah. Hills or
Erin Hills. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think there was a period too where, you know, the USGA didn't go back to Wingfoot. They haven't been back to Wingfoot or Shinnecock until 2 years ago for a while because of maybe said politics, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that should be, I'm really excited. That's probably the thing I'm looking forward to most the rest of the golf season. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You look at the schedule, and certainly the U.S. Open sticks out as being the interesting tournament that we have left in the year, aside from the Masters. We've got the Wyndham this week, and then the FedEx Cup playoffs, and you know, we kind of know what that's going to be like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Olympia Fields will be somewhat interesting, but I think that'll kind of get beat up by these guys. But
have they started the work there? They're supposed to do some work there, right? Yeah,
no,
that's too recent to have come to fruition yet. Yeah,
yeah, they don't know what course they're going to do first, and that's but the one of the things we talked about earlier, the pacing of a round. Mm-hmm. So Harding Park, you kind of had this mixture of gettable holes, tough holes, gettable holes, tough holes. And then you have like your Augusta, where, you know, at Harding Park, Matthew Wolff could have posted a great score and he might have won, right? Mm-hmm. And at Augusta, you post a score, you really have no chance of winning.
Right.
And at Wingfoot, it's, you know, the last five holes, if you post a score, you're probably in the driver's seat. Like, you can't get to the clubhouse soon enough out there.
Yeah, there are courses where the longer you stay out there, the less of a chance you have, and courses where the shorter the time you spend out there, the more of a chance you have. Obviously, at Augusta, you want to be out there late on Sunday having a shot at 13, 15, and 16, and going low. Yeah, it'll be, I don't know, like the winged foot, it'll be, obviously, the 74 Open and the 06. Jeff Ogilvie 06 Open, those were wars of attrition. Like, we remember those well. I wonder if it's possible for that kind of championship to happen anymore. I mean, I know we've had a couple fairly recently, but it's been because the greens have been really hard and things like that. I wonder if it's possible in this era of the USGA and the US Open for there to be a 5-over par winning score at a place like Wingfoot.
I don't think it is.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think that the era of that occasional
championship... Unless you change the par to 68.
Right. Which they might have to start doing pretty soon. But yeah, I mean, I think that era is gone. The time when you have that occasional championship where the winning score is 7-over or whatever, I just don't think we're going to see that anymore unless something kind of goes wrong. And they lose the golf course, you know, to quote ZJ.
Or if it's just crazy windy or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Which, that would Wingfoot in a heavy wind would not be fun at all. So I want to talk more about the Muni aspect. You wrote a piece about the Mega Muni and, you know, the theme of it. And it's TPC Harding Park's one of the few of these where the idea of a community, a city getting behind a municipal course and renovating and pouring money into it with hopes of a championship. And I thought this was just an interesting article topic and something that we have seen less and less, if not any of. There's maybe one attempt here in my city of Chicago recently to get something like this off the ground, and how we've seen a shift to the mini muni. But as we know, trends, they go both directions all the time. They could, you know, we're going to see swings in different directions. Talk a little bit about the Mega Muni and how it's fared across the country.
So the Mega Muni is a kind of municipal course that gets renovated or built with the intention, as you said, of hosting major championships. And, you know, while they are city courses, they do charge high green fees for outsiders while giving discounted rates to locals. But the whole idea is to kind of bring money to town, right? When these championships are held there, the city gets free advertising and everybody's happy about that. And the course gets some extra stature and starts to attract tourists to town. Basically, the golf course is a kind of driver for the local economy. And it's also supposed to fund other things that the local government does. And so the main examples of this that I think currently exist, that currently function as mega munis, are TPC Harding Park, Bethpage Black, Torrey Pines, and then most recently, Chambers Bay. Chambers Bay obviously is a new build, and then the other three are renovations of older courses. And so, you know, I refer to these as mega munis because I think they're pretty distinctive and they represent their kind of own model of municipal golf course. And most of them got built or renovated in the early 2000s. Bethpage Black was the first, right? It got renovated in the late 90s with the intention of hosting the 2002 US Open. And to my mind, that sort of started the trend. Right around 2001, 2002, 2003, you saw Torrey Pines get renovated by Rhys Jones. You saw TPC Harding Park get renovated by Chris Gray and the PGA Tour. And you saw Pierce County government up in Washington start to move on the Chambers Bay build. And so all of these courses kind of came about in the same era. This was the late 90s, early 2000s, and I think it was a result of a couple of factors. One is the rising economy, obviously, of the 90s, but also the Tiger era. People just had a feeling during that early Tiger Woods era that golf was the sport of the future and that it was a really good, high-potential investment to build a big golf course that would attract high green fees and championships. And so all of these courses got built or renovated right around the same time. And obviously they're still with us and they're still kind of doing their thing, hosting championships. But since the recession, no more have been built. And so they're more and more starting to feel like relics of a bygone era of golf course development, of specifically municipal golf course development. And so I thought it was just time to kind of look at those in context and consider, you know, how much are we really rooting for these golf courses would we rather see municipal governments kind of take on smaller golf projects, or do we want to keep seeing them kind of shoot for the stars and build a golf course that has the potential to bring in a lot of revenue? And I should say that, you know, Bethpage Black and Torrey Pines do pretty well.
Oh yeah,
they fund a lot of things and for those local governments. TPC Harding Park hasn't done as well as people thought, but it does fine. You know, it's super busy. And
I'm guessing it's going to do great after this. I think part of the...
I think so, too.
I mean, part of the huge appeal of these championships is seeing people getting a commercial on TV, like you referred to, for the city and also the golf course. And then, you know, the years following where people are going to be like, well, I want to go play where they played that PGA. And I think that is a huge part that Harding Park, like Bethpage, was lucky. They got that championship right after.
Yes.
And yes. I think
it was all part of the plan, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that it was the USGA really drove that. It started in about 1995, and yeah, it happened quickly. But it was, you know, the fact that David Fay, the executive director of the USGA at the time, wanted to take a championship to Bethpage Black is really what drove that.
And I think that's the key, is where these have really thrived has been with the major championship imminently in the future, upon finish. And that, to me, is where I think about it today, is how these could continue. And you could see maybe new places pop up. Munis, Kevin Clark had a great, Kevin Clark, Ringer employee. He's got a great podcast, NFL Ringer Show, but he's an avid golf fan, and he tweeted, I think the PGA Championship, if it wants a real identity, should be the major that plays on great and interesting public muni courses every year. Golf should be fun and accessible, which I think this does have a larger appeal, whether or not, you know, I'm not a fan architecturally of Harding Park, but I am a fan of championships going to munis. And I think where Bethpage and Torrey have succeeded so much is because right when that work is done, they had a championship in the next year or two. And where maybe Harding Park struggled more is that the championship didn't come right away.
Yes. Yeah. This is the first major that they've held, even though obviously the renovation happened almost 20 years ago. So... yeah, I mean, I think you're right that the future of TPC Harding Park is bright. You know, it's going to have a regular tournament there. It's going to be in the public eye pretty often, and maybe that'll drive more and more people to want to go play there. I think certainly after this week, there are a lot of more people who are going to be interested in playing Harding Park. I'm not sure it's been on people's radar in making a golf visit to the Bay Area that Harding Park is a must play, but maybe this week kind of pushed it to must play status because of how well it was received generally. And so there's a lot of hope there. What I need to see, though, what I'd really like to see out of the mega muni model is an ability to fund an entire city's golf system. So San Francisco does have a golf fund, but it's a second priority for TPC Harding Park behind paying back the money that it took to get renovated. And I'm not sure they've really gotten to a point where they can start building that golf fund. And for that reason, you've seen San Francisco very hesitant to renovate courses like Lincoln Park, Glen Eagles, Sharp Park down in Pacifica, which San Francisco owns and has a great history. Those courses have continued to decline in terms of their condition, just the general shape of the facility. They haven't gotten money injected into them since the renovation of Harding Park. And I think that was part of the hope of the movement to renovate Harding Park in the first place, was this will be a great thing for San Francisco golf in general. So maybe that'll happen in the future. Maybe this week has made that more possible. But I would really like to see these mega munis actually do that thing where they're able to lift up all of the golf courses that the city owns around them. You know, I'd love to see Torrey Pines eventually lift up Balboa Park, which frankly is the better golf course, but it doesn't have that tournament held on it, and so it hasn't gotten as much attention. But Balboa Park, city-owned course in San Diego, awesome place, but it needs some attention. It needs a little bit of money put into it that they're not going to spend on the clubhouse, that they're going to spend on the golf course to restore it to that wonderful design that it had in the 1920s. I'd love to see that happen, but even though Torrey Pines makes a lot of money, that just hasn't happened yet. And I'm not sure of the reasons exactly. It may just be the complexities of city government. It may be because Torrey Pines has continued to need renovations, right? They had to go back and undo or redo a lot of the stuff that they did in the first place.
Lots of money for not a lot of work.
I know.
Tell you that much.
Like a ton. And so you just have to wonder, when is this model going to really work in the way that people hoped it would? And I still hope it does. I think it's a great idea. You know, I want cities to have these big golf courses that attract a lot of attention and a lot of cash, and that they're able to use in other ways to lift the city up and improve the services that the local government provides to people. But it just hasn't quite worked that way yet. And I hope it does. And I think once it does, that you'll see more cities trying it.
The other thing with, obviously, in Chicago, Merrivitz, which is a nine-holer right on the lake, and the driving range, Diversey Driving Range, which has got to be one of the best settings for a driving range in the world. But it's also, at the same hand, one of the worst driving ranges in the world. Because of just the ball, it's just a brutal experience going down there. But that driving range and the golf course, Merrivitz, they float all of the other golf courses. They cover up the losses at every other golf course. And then, I know in L.A., the same is for Rancho Park and Rancho Park's driving range, where they basically cover the losses of the rest of the golf courses that LA operates. And it's interesting that in those two cases, the rundown golf course that is, you know, great location, Rancho Park, unbelievable bones, could be a great golf course with some money. It is definitely a great golf course to go play. Chicago's, the driving ranges are such, and maybe that's a way is focusing in on also practice facilities with these mega munis to generate revenue.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got to look at creative ways to use the space. You know, it's not a mega muni if it doesn't have 18 holes. It's not a mega muni if it's not a championship layout, which means that you need to devote a certain amount of room to the golf course. But at a place like Jackson Park and South Shore, where there has been a proposal to turn that into a championship facility for several years now, but that just hasn't found the support or funding that it needs. I think that whole idea, you know, you could quibble with some of the details of it, but the idea as a whole, where you're taking basically 27 holes of golf, turning it into an 18-hole championship course, and then developing a practice facility and a number of other drivers of revenue at the golf course place around the championship layout itself, I think that that's got to be the way to go, because, you know, it just seems like for municipal golf courses specifically, that affordable rounds of golf for local people is not the way that you're going to make money. It's just not. You know, it's a great service for the government to provide. You know, I don't want to knock that part of it. I think we have to remember that these are public facilities that the government is providing to the people. That's a great thing. But yeah, the mega muni model relies on the notion that these courses have a high potential to generate revenue. And yeah, you need to look at other ways to do that than just green fees.
Well, and we've seen with like Winter Park, the mini muni has generated revenue profits for a city of Winter Park, where going the complete opposite direction of the idea of the mega muni has generated money, where it's affordable, it's fun, it's welcoming to beginners. It's not an easy course for, you know, expert players by any means, but it's not challenging for beginners. It's been, and creating a welcoming atmosphere, which that's, I think, one of the issues with the Mega Muni is it never is going to be a welcoming atmosphere to a beginning player. And I think that's one of the pitfalls of it, is that I wonder if there's a way that there could be the Mega Muni, Mini Muni model blended together in any way.
Mm-hmm. And I think Harding Park more or less does that with the Fleming Nine. The Fleming Nine is a Mini Muni. Now, I think it needs to be updated architecturally. I think it could be more fun to play, you know, if it's a course, it's a 9-hole course that's supposed to be for kids and for older people, you know, why not make it a little bit more fun? I mean, it is fun. It's a cool little golf course, but, you know, while Harding Park has gotten some attention and has been kind of polished up, the Fleming Nine has sort of remained more or less the same. So Harding Park does that. That said, there are people who used to play at Harding Park before the renovation who are still mad about the fact that it was turned into this golf facility that charges a bit a higher green fee, even for locals that host championships. They wanted their old golf course.
That's what I kind of think about, is like Harding Park kind of lost its soul when it went mega, because of that, you know, $60 is not expensive for golf, but it's not cheap.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's not where you're going to play every single weekend or multiple times a week, like I think a lot of the Harding Park regulars were in the 90s leading up to the renovation. But, you know, that said, in San Francisco, it's a particular situation because there are plenty of other city golf courses mm-hmm. within a short distance, including inside the routing of Harding Park itself, where you can go to play a cheaper, more casual round of golf. But if a city has fewer golf courses, if it's looking to megafy one of its very few golf courses, then these questions, I think, become a lot more urgent and a lot more difficult to answer. And as you're saying, the Mini Muni, and this is why I said in my article, I think that's the real future of municipal golf. And that even after the success of Winter Park, even after the success of Goat Hill Park and places like that, that it's still not quite catching on the way I'd like to see. And that might be because people are imagining that the only way to renovate a municipal golf course truly is to go the Bethpage Black, TPC Harding Park, Chambers Bay direction. But there are so many other options. And we're starting to see this. You know, we've got the reversible course in Atlanta, the Bobby Jones golf course. We've got Rockwind Community Links, Andy Staples's Community Links model that seems to be appealing to a lot of people. These are creative, smaller, less expensive ways of creating a great municipal golf experience without attaching to the PGA Tour or the USGA or trying to attract championships. But man, I just wish we saw more of it. I wish it were happening at a higher pace. And yeah, I mean, maybe I'm just impatient about it and unrealistic. But I just, you know, there are so many options out there for making municipal golf courses great places to be that don't involve, gunning for a U.S. Open.
Yeah, so this is where I kind of quibble and my kind of opinion on the Chicago project falls, is that I think that became entirely too big of an ask. And one of the aspects of that is they could have started small, and, you know, they had the perfect opportunity with Sidney Maravich, the 9-holer, which is, it's lakefront property. As it is now, it's packed. It's a jam-packed golf course, but that has the opportunity to be one of the best 9-hole golf courses in the world, because of its setting. I mean, I used to play there early in the morning before I'd go to work. I'd play at 5 in the morning and I'd be done at 6:15, 6:30, and watching the sun come up over the lake and playing golf along Lake Michigan and then hitting tee shots with high-rise apartment complexes as your backdrop, it's one of the neatest experiences. And it has this opportunity where you could, and it could have been done for fractions of the money. Obviously, the big hurdle that Jackson Park and any mega muni project is going to run into is funding. And that's the issue that Harding Park's having, is paying back the funding. You know, in where I almost think there is a potential way of the mini muni allowing the mega muni to happen with these big city golf systems, where if you put $2 million and hire a talented young architect at Sidney Maravich, you're going to get an unbelievable golf course there. And then from there, all of a sudden, you've built up the trust. And then that mega muni becomes more of a realistic opportunity.
Yeah, you said it. I mean, trust, community trust, that's such a huge deal. And every project builds it differently. In San Francisco, that was a huge part of the process. Sandy Tatum and the group that he was leading managed to garner the trust of the community and the buy-in of the community enough to make it happen. Now, there are still people who objected to it, for sure, but increasingly toward the end of the project, those voices became more and more marginalized. Jackson Park, the way that they went about introducing that project to the community was all wrong. You know, it was completely top down. People who lived in that area were looking around and saying, I haven't heard anything about this. Who was asking me about this? Completely the wrong way to go about it. Of course they're going to resist it if you're coming in and saying, we're going to blow this place up and turn it into something completely different. And, you know, here we are, a bunch of rich, well-connected people, and you're just going to be grateful for it. No, that's BS. You've got to go about it completely differently. And I think it's a great idea to start small, especially in this day and age when, you know, golf, it's much different than 20 years ago. The idea of golf and the public consciousness right now, you need to help people understand that golf may not be what they think it is. And one of the ways
that it can be intertwined with the community.
Yes, exactly. That places like Winter Park exist and are very woven into the community in an unobtrusive way that, you know, almost everybody is happy with. Now, there are people who even objected to Winter Park. There's always going to be conflict. But I think starting small and showing what a golf course can be and how it can improve a community and how it can be open and accessible to a community, that's huge. And then it makes it a lot more possible, and this is the argument essentially that you're making, a lot more possible that you can make big moves, right? And get that mega muni. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's hard either way to get the funding, even to get a little bit of funding for a small project. That's hard too, you know? And so
I always think back to when I was in sales, I had a boss who told me, you know, here, Andy, one of the things you got to remember when you're selling somebody is, if I came to your house and asked you to put a political sign in your house, and this is not going to be a political statement in any way, we're steering clear of that. It's just about the signs here. But if I come and ask you...
You've reassured me. Thank you, Andy. I'm comfortable now.
If I come ask you to put a small, you know, 8x10-inch sign in your yard, versus if I come and ask you to put a 4-foot by 4-foot sign, you're way more likely to put the 8x10-inch sign in your yard than right off the bat. But if I get that 8-inch by 10-foot sign in your yard, and then I come back in, you know, 6 weeks or whatever, 4 weeks, and I say, hey, you know, I got some bigger signs. Do you mind if I put this bigger sign? The chances of the person saying yes to the bigger sign are exponentially more likely now that they've had the small sign in there. And I think the same thing goes for golf within these local is just being able to start small. And if it's a muni that's a little worse for the wear, that has seen better days, even if you get them to just do a small project that really significantly upgrades the golf course and does it at a small capital expenditure, is the way to get that bigger spend, because you've shown, hey, we can improve this, and then the community and the bottom line sees a benefit from it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, we've seen that approach succeed usually in smaller towns. You know, I can't think of a big city that has gone about it in this way, because big cities are just, you can't do anything ever. But yeah, that seems very reasonable. The issue is that it's almost like it's easier to do the huge project because it attracts people and their money. Whereas if you talk about something small, it's not going to appeal as much to the people with the money. You just kind of have to do those smaller things on your own. It has to be your own initiative. You know, I'm starting to get this to know the superintendent down in Eugene, Oregon at Laurelwood Golf Course. And he's been there for almost for 10 years, maybe even up to 15 years now. And he's just been making these gradual improvements to the course. And he's really turned that place around. But it's been so hard. And that's a 9-hole course. And the things that he's been doing have been, you know, minor, very minor compared to the mega muni renovations that we were talking about earlier. And it's been just all his energy and initiative and talent. All of that has been necessary to make even the smallest things happen. And so it's just hard. And yeah. Yeah,
here's somehow. one other thing I wanted to touch on briefly with Harding Park. So they adjusted and narrowed their fairway lines for this championship. What do you think the chances of those fairway lines ever getting pushed back out to their original size again are?
I'd say that's pretty small, right? Don't you think?
Isn't that messed up?
Yeah, totally. But it's now the PGA Championship course, right? That's the PGA Championship course. So why would they change it? People want to come and play the PGA Championship course now. They come and they see wider fairways, and that might be disappointing. I mean, that said, you know, Pebble Beach consistently takes its fairways in and puts them back out after the U.S. Open comes to town. But that's Pebble Beach. You know, it's not a municipal golf course. So, yeah, no, that I agree. That's a bummer. What do you think they're going to do about the rough? The rough is got to be going to go lower, right? They're going to.
When I played it in March, it was not high, but It was still just so punishing.
That's because that grass, you know, yeah. It's just, yeah, it's gnarly.
It's just was not an enjoyable experience. I was not driving the ball well, and I was just in the rough all day. And it, you know, that you saw the best players in the world. The rough wasn't necessarily that long, but they were hitting shots that were just incredibly horrible because of, you know, how thick it is and how. But
that course is unbelievably hard for an average golfer, and it raises the whole subject of whether it's possible for one of these courses to truly be enjoyable for the average golfer. And this is where we need to shout out Chambers Bay, which I think pulls this off really well. You know, that's a fun golf course, but it obviously was plenty hard for the players in the 2015 U.S. Open. Now, the reason that it was hard then was that it was firm. Obviously, and the players didn't like that. And if the championship went back, maybe it wouldn't be the same way. But, you know, the way that it goes about being challenging for good players, but accessible for less skilled players, I think is really admirable and presents a better model, frankly, than Harding Park and Torrey Pines.
Yeah, I think that's one of my big complaints about, you know, what happens when the mega muni comes is then the golf course, the key golf course characteristic tends to, you know, center around difficulty. And you know, when that happens, then bad architectural decisions are made. And, you know, for every 10 years it has the major championship, every 20 years it has the major championship, there's 52 weeks for those 20 years, 1 week, you know, I can't do the math in my head, 1,000 weeks of pain and suffering for the regular players versus the 1 week where it stands up to the best players in the world, or doesn't, because that's the other thing. Sometimes it just doesn't even stand up to them.
Right. Well, it was a par 70 this week, so we should always remember that too when we look at the final sort of what was it, minus 13 number, that this was a par 70 golf course. But maybe that's fine. You know, maybe people really want to come and get abused at the PGA Championship venue. Maybe they want the same from the Torrey Pines South course.
Well, then they built the North course the same way. That's the big blunder on San Diego's.
I mean, it's a little wider and the greens are a little, but no, you're right. And Balboa Park also, I'll go back there again. The whole idea is, okay, so if you're going to set up a championship course for one of your courses, the other courses in the city should be different. And that's what I'm looking for out of San Francisco. You know, put a little bit of money into Lincoln Park or Glen Eagles and make those courses what they should be. And if you can do that, then great. You know, make the fairways at Harding Park even narrower, make the rough even higher, you know, whatever you have to do. If that enables you to attract enough money to fix up your other golf courses, then awesome. I'm fine with it. But it doesn't seem like that's quite happening yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Mega Beauty, we'll see what happens next. I'm sure there's going to be a proposed project pop up one of these days somewhere. Yeah.
I mean, Memorial Park is the closest thing that has happened in recent years. That's kind of a Mega Muni, but I don't think they're looking for a major championship.
That's an interesting one, too, in the architectural sense. They didn't hire the open doctor. They hired the guy that's known for building the most playable golf courses.
Right. Tom Duck. Yeah. So, Yeah. What's that tournament going to be like? I don't really know. You know, the Trinity Forest experience has made me a little bit gun shy about best practices of current architecture as it matches up with the PGA Tour. So, you know, I hope Memorial Park works out. And it certainly seems like Doak was intentional about reaching out to players and asking them what they thought, you know, involving Brooks Koepka and all that kind of stuff. And so maybe it'll work out a little better. But I think that's going to be an important moment for the kind of nexus between high-level tournament golf and current golf course design. You know, that could be a moment where we either go one direction or another. If it works out brilliantly, if they all love the course, then maybe we'll get a few more like it. If they hate it and it's a disaster, then I'm afraid about what's going to happen next.
I know that, you know, Tom's talked extensively on the podcast about, you know, the slopes and the greens and they're being handcuffed there. So I think what we'll see is probably a low score and, you know, a golf course that's Trinity Forest without as much, as not, you know, necessarily to stereotype it, but Trinity Forest-esque from tee to green, but then on the green, very, very tame.
Yeah. Well, I'll take it still. Yeah. You know?
It's better than the TPC circuit.
That's right.
So, all right, Garrett, any parting thoughts?
No, I mean, what a great week of golf, and I'm definitely looking forward to the U.S. Open.
Yeah, yeah, awesome week of golf, and it's cool to see golf on a municipal golf course.
Absolutely, and it's so cool to see Colin Morikawa win there, and you know, the whole story is just great. Yeah, obviously it got driven into the ground by the telecast, but the fact that he is familiar with the area, has roots in the area, and is emerging just now as a superstar at this municipal course, fantastic stuff. And I think that we'll definitely remember this one. This will be a major kind of point in the history of this part of the tournament golf's history, and so yeah, we're just processing it now.